The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to an exciting episode of Arthropod. I'm your host, Michael Scavarla with Penn State University. I'm joined by Dr. Andy Deans of the Frost Museum and the Entomology Department here at Penn State. Today, we're going to talk about some of the work that Andy's done and his work with the museum and collections-based research. So strap in. I hope we have a good talk, and I hope you like it. So just to begin, Andy, how did you get into entomology? What's your bug story?
Yeah, that's a good question. I get asked that a lot. I mean, I guess I've always been interested in biology. I grew up in Massachusetts, and I would spend my afternoons and weekends in the woods or visiting my grandmother, who lived on Buzzards Bay, right on the coast. And so I do a lot of tide pooling. I did a lot of rock flipping, log rolling, looking for salamanders, snakes, looking at intertidal organisms, trying to learn the diversity. So I knew I wanted to be a biologist. I went to University of New Mexico for my undergrad. And while I was there, I got involved in some bat projects. So I was working on, through the Museum of Southwestern Biology, they had projects where they go out and collect bats and then try to understand parasite loads of bats, depending on whether they're communal roosters or solitary roosters, like those kinds of questions. And I was there as like, helping out, helping collect the bats and pick parasites off them and then make bat preps.
Oh, cool. So were you looking at like bat flies and
exactly
that kind of thing?
We collected tons and tons of bat flies, which I'd love to have now, but I think they all went to the field museum.
Those are really cool parasites. I kicked around the idea of doing a bat project for my PhD just so I could work on the bat flies.
Totally.
And it never came to fruition, and I did other things, but I get the draw. That's really
neat. So, I mean, I started to get into these little guys, the little organisms, right, that including insects, around this point. So by interacting with the bats and their parasites, and then I took a class on parasitology, I got really interested in the sort of parasitic lifestyle, life history strategy. And then at one point I thought, I'm getting towards the end of my bachelor's, why don't I do some sort of project where I'm looking at internal parasites like cestodes, nematodes, and see if I can correlate those with diet. This is like the naive mammologist. Like, we'll just figure out what these things are eating, right? We're collecting some bats. We're dissecting out certain organs and putting them in like tubes for to be frozen. Why don't I just pull the stomachs, open them up, look at the gut contents, and then also set up like light traps and try to compare what's in the gut to what we were collecting on the sheet or on the light trap. I remember putting out our first like UV trap and just being like overwhelmed by the diversity. I like mammals. There's like, 40 species of bats or something in North America. And there's probably like 40 species of noctuids at the light right now. Never mind all the other insects.
So like you could easily learn every species of bat in hand to identify.
Yeah. And so I remember thinking, okay, here's this wealth of diversity of arthropods. And then you cut open the bat gut and it's just like a gray mush. I'm like, this is no way I'm going to correlate, or try to identify things, especially as an undergrad with no training. Mm-hmm. But I remember getting really into the insects we were collecting. I'm like, okay, well, let's see if we can figure these out. And I went to the library and took out, the third edition of Bohr and DeLong, and started reading about insect diversity. They didn't have an insect diversity class at the time there. And then stumbling upon parasitoid Hymenoptera and just being like, this is the group. I'm not studying anything else. These things are amazing. I had no idea about this array of life history strategies just within Hymenoptera.
Oh, that's
really
cool.
How I got sort of into entomology. From there on, pursued degrees, graduate degrees in entomology.
That's really cool because I've heard a lot of people either say I was interested in insects specifically since I was a kid, or as an undergrad, I had this insect entomology class because I needed some kind of biology class and it fit. And I've never heard I was into biology and then picked up an entomology book and that's what did it. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, there was just so much. I knew I wanted to do systematics. Like, I was interested in that. And there's a great group of mammalogists at UNM, I think, still there. And I remember thinking, like, I could do systematics of mammals and describe a couple of species, or I could do systematics of Hymenoptera and just describe hundreds or thousands of species. It just made me, like, the opportunities were so much greater, I guess, in entomology with this taxon for doing systematic.
Like, that's part of the draw for me, too, is it's just so easy to find something that nobody else has seen, or at least described.
I remember also thinking with Hymenoptera, like, if it doesn't work out in academia or something, there's got to be an applied.
Oh, yeah, going into the field and using them for some kind of biocontrol.
Or like, I could see that there would be an applied angle, mm-hmm. and I figured, well, maybe I'll make myself more marketable that way.
That's not the worst idea. I like it.
Yeah.
So within parasitic Hymenoptera, right now you're doing Ebeneids. Has that always been a passion, the cockroach wasps?
No. I mean, I started with my master's working on Braconids, family Braconidae, you know, which is like tens of thousands of described species and probably tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of undescribed species. And Braconids were amazing. But I remember thinking like that, feeling like there would be other opportunities if I looked to groups that didn't have like any steward or anybody working on them. And so the family Ebeneidae, the ensign wasps, I mean, nobody had touched this group for 100 years or something at the point of me when I was just starting my PhD work. So I felt like I loved the idea of taking a group that looked super interesting, but which had nobody working on it. And I felt like it would give me a lot of freedom. So that's why I picked ensign wasps in particular. It's like an orphaned group that were large and charismatic. And I felt like if I could be the one, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's like an ego thing, but if I could be the one to resurrect this group and make them available for research, like, who knows, there could be all kinds of cool things that come out of it.
And you don't have to worry about people elbowing and, like,
getting scooped.
Putting their flag on this subfamily, this is what I work on. I'm glad you pointed out, I called them cockroach wasps. They parasitize cockroaches, but I believe ampulicids are cockroach wasps.
Cockroach wasps.
Poor use of common names on my part.
Yeah, well, that's the common name problem, I guess.
Could you describe for the listeners just a little bit about their biology? Because I don't think it's a group most people know.
Yeah, well, it's a group even scientists don't really know. I mean, so it's about 500 species found worldwide. The bulk of diversity, like for many insects, is in the tropics. And we don't have very many rearing records, but as far as we can tell, what you get is a female laying a single egg inside a cockroach egg case, an ootheca. And the egg hatches and a single larva will develop by eating most of the cockroach eggs. Then it'll pupate inside the ootheca. And then when it's ready to close and emerge, it'll chew a hole in the ootheca and fly out. So you get one egg laid, as far as we know, in an ootheca, one wasp developing from that. They've been researched a little bit for their potential as like biocontrol agents of cockroaches. But
yeah, there's some that hit like American cockroaches.
Exactly. But I think they don't make a lot of, like, one ensign wasp doesn't make a lot of ensign wasps, mm-hmm. right? It maybe lays a handful of eggs over its lifetime. And I think it's not as efficient as some chalcedoid predators of cockroach eggs are.
Yeah. And you think they're reasonably sized. It'd be something to see all these, like, medium-sized ensign wasps flying around buildings.
Exactly.
And cockroaches.
It's funny, there was, I can't remember the authors now, but there was a paper published maybe in the 70s or 80s. I have it referenced somewhere, but where they went into housing developments and interviewed people about the ensign wasps and then tried to do, like, a before and after assessment of their attitudes. So they would show these wasps or talk about these wasps, and the tenants would sort of say, yes, they're annoying, or I don't like them, or I'm scared of them, and I'm afraid I'll be bit or stung. Mm-hmm. And then there was like an educational, like an extension sort of program to be like, hey, well, let me tell you about these wasps. they're predators of cockroach eggs, and they help reduce the cockroach population, et cetera. And then they went and like reassessed people's opinion of the wasp, and people were much more sort of tolerant and happy about having them around.
Yeah, when they see like that thing is killing the cockroaches that I hate.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Can they, if you just physically grab it, I mean, some parasitoids can sting. Will they sting if you force them to?
I don't think so. I mean, their ovipositors are really flexible and thin. I've never been stung by one, but they will bite, but it's like, you know, you barely feel it.
Yeah. So they're most diverse in the tropics. What's diversity like here? Do we have very many of them?
Yeah, I mean, here in Pennsylvania, there's about 5 species, maybe 7 if you include the introduced ones.
Okay,
that's so it's a handful.
That's
yeah,
not terrible.
Yeah, and they're not rare. I mean, I see them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I see them pretty often.
In malaise traps, or just like out flying around in the environment?
I mean, really? Certainly get it. Yeah, especially the genus Hyptia, which is a small. Pretty small one. It has almost no wing veins. It's pretty recognizable. And they're predators of Parkablada.
Okay.
Ootheke. So yeah. We have Parkablada like all around my house. And so we occasionally get
to the wasps around. Yeah. Oh, neat. Okay. So that's a bit about what you've done.
Yeah.
And part of your job here is being in charge of the Frost Museum, which is the entomology research museum on campus. Can you tell us a bit about the museum, maybe some history and stats in that?
Yeah. So as I understand it, it didn't really exist as a museum or even a unified collection until the late 1960s. So if we go back even, you know, well before then, Stuart Frost, our namesake, came to Penn State in the 1920s, and he had been collecting insects since he was 8 years old. So he came here with a sizable collection. And I think there were already on campus several reference collections that people had in their offices or whatever.
Just built for whatever they were doing.
Exactly. So Stuart Frost was a professor here. He retired in 1957, you know, and he'd been collecting extensively over that period of time. And then he lived until 1980. So that's a good chunk of years, a couple decades there where he continued to collect and even maybe even ramped up to his collecting in retirement. Spent his winters at Archbold Biological Station in Florida. And so we have a sizable collection of arthropods that he collected from that down that way. So he was continuing his collection up through the 60s, but sort of storing it haphazardly, like at his home in drawers that were just sort of stacked up in cabinets. So my predecessor, Casey Kim, who started, I think, in 1968, that was one of his first things that he did was to lobby for proper storage and then to aggregate this collection along with other collections into a unified museum. My understanding also is that Stuart Frost had a vision or at least a desire to have a public interface. Like he has this big collection. He built a series of these small displays, portable displays in like small Schmidt boxes that he would presumably show people, I guess, during outreach events or had them mounted somewhere where they could be seen. So that's what they did. They established the Frost Entomological Museum and based on his collection and set up a public space.
That seems really late in the game for a public land-grant institution to be, like, that had an entomology department from the beginning to be establishing their research collection, especially because it's, we've got, what, between 1 and 2 million specimens now?
I might revise that. Yeah, it's not small. I mean, I feel like even a million might be an overestimate now that we're in there poking around, digitizing
really
stuff.
Really seeing what's there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we didn't always have a entomology. I think entomology is only about 50 years old.
Oh, really?
As a department. Yeah, I mean, we were one of the original land grants, mm-hmm. but
I thought we were here from the beginning, but no.
I don't think so as an entomology department. It used to be a zoology.
Oh.
Department. So it was like, you know, biologists. Mm-hmm. I don't really know the history back before the origin of our department.
Okay.
But that's my understanding. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we've been a land grant from the beginning, and I think there's always been collections on campus, but not really sort of aggregated into one.
Yeah. One place.
Yeah.
And so we've got the Frost collection. There's a couple other reasonably sized collections that have been donated and incorporated, right?
Oh, yeah. So part of that is the John Pepper aphid collection, which I've been told by aphidologists is like a top 5 collection for North America with about 32,000 slide mounted specimens.
Yeah, I've looked through it and they're really nicely done.
I think he was well known as someone who could make a grid prep of an aphid. And what's special about that collection as well is that I think it spans about 50 years, and it's mostly hitting the same locations over and over again. So you have this like transect through time.
Oh, that'd be great if somebody could go through and maybe resample those and start looking at things like climate change.
I think there's an opportunity there. The other special collection is this Dragonfly and Damselfly collection that was put together by George and Alice Beattie from about 1940s up through about 1970. Yeah, that's also just really special collection. I mean, it's they were Odonata enthusiasts and collected extensively. I don't think George worked. I think he had money that he had inherited, so he spent almost all his time working on Odonata. And Alice was a professor at Penn State Du Bois, but also, you know, she did her PhD work on Odonata. They're just really passionate collectors and naturalists, and did several expeditions to Mexico in the 1950s and 60s. They did expeditions to Canada and other places, and didn't just collect extensively at these locations. They actually collected larvae and or naiads, if you will, and reared them. Which for some Odonata is incredibly difficult, from what I understand, especially things like gomphids, which live in lotic environments. They don't rear very well unless you can mimic that in your lab. And they worked up some kind of system. We have this massive reared collection of Odonata where we have like drawings of the larvae. We have the exuvia.
I was going to ask if the exuvia are safe too. So now you can link up that exuvia with the known adult.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
And extensive field notes with all kinds of drawings.
Oh, wow. It's so amazing. This may be getting a bit out of what you know, but how is that within Odonates, naiads and adults being linked? Does it, do you know if that's well known? Because I guess I don't.
In terms of the terminology?
I guess in terms of like this species of naiad goes to this species.
Oh, so I always assumed it was not well known. I mean, there's a lot of people interested in Odonata, but I find that they're usually focused on adult stages.
Right.
But apparently there's a book in prep that is like I think it's a field guide to larvae.
So maybe it'll be a little keys easier. And things.
Yeah, so I want to say that is like...
We're kind of talking out of what Tennyson. Neither of us knows really well.
Yeah, I think it's Ken Tennyson, maybe.
Okay, so maybe something to look out for.
Yeah.
I've always avoided Odonates because if you don't kill them the right way, the colors fade.
Yeah, I know.
And that happened with the first dozen or so that I caught, like... They look great, and then I pinned them, and the colors faded, and then I just threw my hands up and said, nope, not doing these guys.
They just look like greasy brown. I know.
They're gorgeous as adults. I get it.
I mean, the behaviors, the morphological adaptations, they're just incredible insects.
Yeah. So we're digitizing those right now. Is there any kind of ongoing research with that? Or kind of collection in the collection?
Yeah, so we do have funding from NSF to digitize portions of the collection, and one of the ones we targeted as a high priority was Odonata. Our collection is mostly stored in like little paper triangles or in cellophane envelopes that are about the size of a 3x5 card. And you have a 3x5 card in there with data on it. So the good thing about that type of storage is that it's amenable for photography, and we can just like slide it under a camera, snap a picture, go on to the next one.
Oh yeah, you just set like a jig up for the photo, exactly. And just everything's the same.
Which is good for capturing like locality data and getting a sort of a sense of what the specimen looks like, its state, you know, whether it's in good shape. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can probably confirm some IDs or at least be confident that that's probably pretty close if it's not right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we've done these snapshots of all of the envelopes and triangles in the collection. That's about 65,000 specimens. And now we're transcribing the labels, the label data, and then trying to assign a latitude and longitude and error for each of those localities.
Okay.
So we can get a sense of where these Odonata were collected in time and space. And one of the students in the collection, Emily Sandel, is working on like niche modeling to try to understand, to see if we can apply some environmental factors or try to understand why certain Odonates have the distributions that they do.
Okay.
You know, certain type of water, certain type of like soil type or whatever.
Substrate to water is going through.
Yeah.
a lot of these things, you'd assume they should be more widespread because streams are everywhere and lakes are everywhere. So why are they restricted?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember picking up one of Paulson's field guides to Odonata and like just flipping through it and looking at distributions. You know, there's like a little map, you know, with shading on it where the species has been found, and just being surprised at how disjunct and crazy they looked. Like they didn't match any kind of geography I could understand.
Yeah.
Like a patch over here in Ohio and then like another patch down here in South Carolina with like some over here. And I don't know. I just feel like there's got to be some story there that we haven't discovered yet. Or maybe it's just sampling bias.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense to me, I guess, because some of them are really strong flyers and maybe they get blown off in a storm or something. But then how do you maintain genetic diversity and not speciate or something? That's really neat.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've kind of been getting into some of the research that's going on with the collection. Because is there any other research you'd like to highlight that we're using in the collection before we get into some other discussions about collections research?
Yeah. I mean, I have lots of ideas, you know, so we have funding from National Science Foundation, as I mentioned, to digitize portions of the collection. And usually you do it to fit some sort of research theme, right? These are thematic collection network grants. And our theme was for the one that funds our work is basically like Northeast biodiversity, like changes over time. So we digitized all of our beetles. Just because it's like a tractable group for us and they're interesting and lots of people are working on them. And I feel like my colleagues working on weevils might want our weevil data.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we've transitioned to targeting mimics and their models. So I had, we've digitized like our vespid wasps our crabronid wasps and tried to find things that look vaguely waspish, like serpent flies and stratiomyid flies and some select sphingids, cicadids,
things that you look at them and you think like, that's modeling something.
Exactly. So I had this project I designed for an undergrad a couple of years ago about mimicry and seeing if we can use collections data to test hypotheses about mimicry. And like, would you expect the distribution of a mimic to be smaller than its model? But it was like way too ambitious for an undergrad to do. And it's
more like a master's level project.
Yeah, it was like pretty big. And it's a body of literature that's pretty big. And it's not one I had much experience with in terms of like doing the background. But we plowed forward and have now digitized things that we consider to be mimics of aculeate wasps. And next thing is to georeference those and see if we can start getting data download from GBIF and see if there's any patterns. Yeah.
That makes me think there was a Mutilid paper out in the last year or two. I don't know if you saw it, where it looked at these mimicry rings from Mutilids.
Joe Wilson and colleagues.
Yeah, where you've got like a mimicry ring in the east and then another one in the west. And I mean, after I saw that paper, I was like, oh yeah, that makes
sense. Yeah, totally.
Like, now I see it because I've seen Mutilids in the east and they all do look the same.
Yeah. No, that's a cool paper, and mimicry just in general is an interesting system.
Oh, that'll be neat then to get it to vespids and other things that look like them. Okay, so we've kind of talked around it a bit because we're discussing research that's going on in the museum. So it's kind of transitioned into collections-based research and why we need to save these collections and fund them and make sure that they're still around 20 or 50, 100 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like very strongly, and I feel like the research community is also behind supportive of collections in a way that they hadn't been maybe 20 years ago. I mean, these are just massive resources for all kinds of data that we can't, you know, collect again, right? I mean, so it's like a repository of specimens, which includes locality data, it includes DNA, includes artifacts like pollen that's stuck to their bodies or whatever. So it's like this repository that goes back in time, and we could revisit this library of specimens to address all kinds of research questions that you couldn't do otherwise. Like, you can't go back in time to 1960 and see what sorts of pollen are on these bumblebees, right? But you can go in the collection and sample it.
And use that as a metric to like see what kind of flowers are around or.
Yeah. I mean, you just never know how a natural history collection is going to be useful or a necessary. You can't really predict often, you know.
Well, 30 years ago, we didn't really have great DNA technology, and now you can go to a specimen collected in the 1800s and extract DNA and start asking questions you never even could have imagined.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like a source of potential research. It's just huge, like the latent potential of this, of natural history collections for all kinds of creative research is, it's infinite. But also just, you know, it's important to have specimens as references, as a source of data for understanding taxonomy or what's a new species. I mean, you need to have these vouchers that stand for taxonomic concepts. But even as a source of, like, for me, inspiration, as an undergrad, I worked in the Museum of Southwestern Biology, and I was surrounded by, I was in the mammal range, I was surrounded by mammals. I remember this, every time I'd walk into work, I was greeted with this giant jar that had, like, a flying fox bat inside it, you know, and just like being inspired by those organisms and wanting to know more about them. And then it made the excitement level of seeing these things alive that much greater. Like if I'm working with these specimens and trying to understand diversity of their fur colors and where they've been collected in the past, and then I go out on a field trip with a group of researchers and there's a live one. I mean, just like, it was magical. So it's a source for inspiration, which I think is one reason Stuart Frost wanted to have some sort of public interface with this massive collection. He recognized that there could be potential to inspire others.
Well, especially with insects. I mean, the interest is there. It's a small jump to get people inspired.
Exactly.
About it.
That they're already, the interest is already there. And as a source of, you know, it's like a tool for education. Like we're an entomology department training 50 plus graduate students and understanding, you know, insects and their importance. And so having a reference collection that allows them to really understand and learn the diversity of insects and how you recognize certain groups, I think is just incredibly important.
So you mentioned that in the last 20 years, researchers really come around the idea of collections and collections-based research. Do you feel the same with the public, or were they still... Do you feel like they still look at collections and think, why am I supporting this old dusty museum that I can't ever go in or don't ever go in?
Right. It's a good question. I haven't surveyed the public, nor have I seen really any data recently about it. I can tell you from my personal experience through, you know, when my parents have friends in town and they want to see the museum and I give them a tour, or last fall we did this Osher Lifelong Learning Institute course, Ollie course, you know, which was mostly people who are retired or retirement age coming to the museum, learning about collections research, learning about the institution. Everything I've heard from them has been like supportive and like they're fascinated, and they, I don't know that they fully get it, but I don't think any of them, I never got the impression that any of them felt like this was a waste of taxpayer dollars or, I don't know, I felt like they were inspired. They left being like, wow, I can't believe how small that wasp was or whatever.
That's good to hear because, I mean, especially, maybe I shouldn't go here, but especially at the federal level now, it seems like a lot of these kind of things are on the chopping block.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you lose it, if you decommission a 150-year-old museum, you don't really get that information back. Like you mentioned, you can't go back and collect in the 1960 or 1860 and...
Yeah.
Get that back.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful because when I talk to scientists now, I think they increasingly get it. Some of my colleagues who are not systematists and don't normally do collections-based research, they are either finally recognizing that there's honeybees in our collection that they might be able to sample DNA or pollen from. There's increasing recognition of the relevance or importance of voucher specimens, right? So another thing I try to drive home in my course every fall to incoming grad students. Some of them have even put some funding in their grants for storage, specimen storage. And
like, we're going to put 10,000 specimens in the museum. Let's support putting that in there instead of putting it all on you as the museum.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could see it around me. But also, you know, at NSF, there's this ADBC program, the Advancing Digitization of Biological Collections. I mean, that's not a small program. It's like $100 million over 10 years to digitize specimens and collections. So I think there's a recognition on the community, at least, or even at the federal level with NSF, that there's this potential, latent potential that exists in these hundreds of thousands or hundreds of millions of specimens. But we need to liberate the data.
And we're getting there.
We're getting
slowly.
There. It
turns out that digitizing millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of specimens takes a while.
Yeah. Especially getting the data sort of cleaned up and usable for research. So I feel, I feel like I'm hopeful for where things are going.
Okay. Well, that's, I like that. I think we can wrap it up there. We'll end it on a hopeful note.
Okay.
So with that, thanks, Andy, for
it's my pleasure.
Walking across the street and up to my office for the interview.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can check out Arthropod on the internet at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter at mscavarla36. You can check out the Frost Museum on Twitter at Frost Museum. And you can check out the Frost Curator's blog at sites.psu.edu/frost.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Thanks again for listening to this latest episode of Arthropod. Andy stuck around in my office for a few minutes after we were done recording and started telling me a story of how he got lost in Costa Rica as a graduate student. I thought it was too good to pass up and that our Arthropod listeners may want to hear it. So I asked him if we could record it and he said yes. The intro is a little bit jumpy because I just cut him off mid-sentence to ask if we could record it. And it doesn't really fit with the rest of the interview, so I've tacked it on here to the end. It's about 20 minutes long, but stick around if you want to listen to how Andy got lost and found again.
Well, I was going up with a group of student researchers who were at Guanacaste National Park for the summer, and some of Gusaneros who worked for Dan Jansen collecting.
Is that like the naturalist local?
It's a parataxonomist. Okay, they're out collecting caterpillars that they take to these rearing stations. They're trying to match larvae with adults.
I've seen that. I went down there once. Yeah, it's insane.
Operation.
Industrial taxonomy.
It is. Anyway, we took a vehicle up to Volcan Cacao, where the cod forest is. We walked up to where the station is where they do the rearing up there. And then I was like, I'm going to go for a little hike on my own. I wanted to go to the summit and see like the crater or whatever is up at the top of the volcano.
Is there marked trails and stuff, or was it like you bushwhacked?
In the beginning it was, yeah. There's like following these little signs and the trail was kind of obvious. I was pretty dehydrated because the day before I had done this really long hike and must not have rehydrated myself. And I remember hiking up the volcano and then getting to this point where I'm like, I'm not sure where the trail goes from here. And like turning around and not being able to see where the trail is at all. Like looking in all directions and all you see are trees around you. And then thinking like, oh my God. Well, so my strategy in this sort of like dehydrated, somewhat deranged state was like, well, I'm just going to almost like a moth or wasp flying when they do these like zigzags to try to like pick up.
Oh yeah.
Like, I'm just going to zigzag it. And at some point I'm going to run cross the trail and then I can follow it downhill or whatever.
Yeah. Presumably you're going uphill. So if you just go downhill.
Exactly. So I remember like zigzagging and it just got, the vegetation just got denser and denser and denser. And this cloud forest, I don't remember what the plant was, but there were these like viney looking shrubs that were covered in thorns. And I remember at one point I just like stopped and the vegetation all around me was so dense that I couldn't even move. And I just looked around. And I was like, I'm lost, man. I'm lost.
Jeez.
I had to get down on my belly and like crawl in the mud. In the cloud forest, it's all like constant, like pissing down rain. I'm like crawling through the mud like the Marines or whatever, like you'd see in basic training. And just getting like, it's just getting worse and worse. And at some point I went through this really thick vegetation and emerged on the other side and there's like a cliff and I'm like, how am I going to get down? Where am I? And at some point, you see, like, the lights getting, like, darker and darker. Like, the sun is clearly, like, setting and
running out of time.
Yeah, I mean, I started to, like, panic a little bit. You know, you start to feel like, oh, my God, am I going to get out of here? And all I could think about, really, was not so much my own well-being, but the fact that there's this group of people who are probably looking for me. And,
yeah, like,
worried
it's pretty
me.
Obvious at this point that you're
that
gone.
I'm not coming back, yeah. At some point, it was too dark to move. I didn't have a flashlight or anything. I didn't expect to be out overnight. I remember just crawling under this big rock next to a river. Somehow I'd found some river. And just like...
didn't know it was there.
Just starting to cry. Just being like, I'm going to die out here. I'm hopelessly lost. No one's ever going to find me. I'm so stupid. Like mosquitoes. I remember like pulling my rain jacket up and like tying it tight. And I couldn't enclose my face. And just had like mosquitoes all on my face.
Oh my
I'm like trying to sleep under this rock. Oh, so uncomfortable. But I remember the next day, I don't think I really got much sleep. Did you spend the night out there? Yeah, I spent the night out there with like rain coming down, no shelter, thinking I'm going to die, feeling hopeless. And then, I must have fallen asleep a little bit or something, got some sort of rest. I wouldn't call it sleep, but I remember waking up the next day, the sun up. At this point, I had made it into the rainforest. So I was like going down the wrong side of the mountain. I thought I was going down the dry side.
Oh.
I was going down the other side of the mountain, away from like the clearing, the open spaces. I remember seeing like a morpho flying and being like, all of a sudden, like, I'm going to make it out of here. I'm going. I remember filling up my water bottles.
Just with the river water
and drinking it.
I mean, parasites 3 days from now is better than dying now.
Exactly. That was my thinking. And then I just started hiking. I followed the river. I figured at this point, this river is going to take me somewhere. And like, it just got a little bit more open, a little bit more ag looking. I could smell cows. And my water started to smell like cow. I saw a house, like a little cabin, I guess. And there was a family there. And I didn't speak Spanish, but in some broken Spanish, just tell them that I'm a gringo. I remember them giving me some bread and some like juice to drink. And
did they know where you came from?
I can't remember now. I think that they had heard that somebody was lost, or they knew to take me to. There was another biological station on the rainforest side. So they went and they got their horses. They got three horses, and they put me on one of them. And they got there were two guys who got on the other horses, and we went on this 3-hour like horse ride to these little remote villages in the rainforest. And we're getting to the other station. They're like, they knew who I was. They're like, I know who you are. And they like radioed it in.
That's incredible.
Yeah, but it's like, I also remember urinating. This is earlier in the story. When I was up at the top of the mountain, the other thing that scared me was when I urinated, it was like Coca-Cola, right? It was just like a sign of myoglobinuria or I can't remember the other one, but it's like, marchers, whatever they call it.
Yeah,
it's like a sign that you're dehydrated, mm-hmm. like your tissues are breaking down. I remember that, not understanding it and being so freaked out, like I thought I was going to die. Anyway, my urine the next day was more or less back to normal because I was drinking that river water.
Yeah. Did you pick up anything from the river?
I did. I had Giardia. Yeah.
That's what I did.
It was like a cup. This event happened. Like, I was in Costa Rica all summer, and this getting lost happened just a few days before I was going back to the U.S. When I got back to the U.S., that's when the symptoms.
So you could get proper treatment.
Yeah, yeah. But even there, I could have gotten proper treatment if it hit me there. But
how densely populated is it? Like, you ran across a house by chance. Like, if you would have just gone in any direction, would that have happened eventually?
I think eventually. Well, I realize now looking at the map that I would have hit a road eventually. And that's what I was hoping, that there would be some bridge over this little river.
Yeah,
that was following.
Just something.
I mean, there's definitely other little cabins or little small houses, casitas, I guess. Mm-hmm. And there was a little village that I maybe would have run into if I had kept going. The other thing that's funny is that...
Man, it's still scary.
It's scary. Well, yeah, scary. It was definitely scary at the time. I really didn't think I was going to make it out. And I just remember feeling so bad for all those people who must have been looking for me and worried.
Yeah.
And that I had put them through this trauma. The other thing that's funny is that I had been using Dan Jansen's email account. This was 2001 or whatever, and they had internet, but it wasn't like easy to access or whatever. So I would send emails back home to my parents occasionally using Dan Jansen's emails. So when Dan heard that I was lost, he went through his emails and found an email address that I had been corresponding mm-hmm. with, but didn't know that it was my mom, and typed up this long message about how I'm lost. You know,
maybe not the best person to send it to right away.
Because he's so blunt. He was like, really, really, like, he's lost. I'm going to be honest with you. There's a lot of venomous snakes up there. Jaguars. If he wasn't killed by a jaguar, he was probably killed by a venomous snake. He's in good shape, though, so he might make it out. But
it was like... When I visited the Dry Forest, we got the these big leather things for your shins because there's so many venomous snakes that, stepping over a log, you don't know if you're going to get bit.
Well, I know the people, the Gusaneros who worked up in that cloud forest were really, I mean, they talked about venomous snakes as if they were on every tree.
Yeah.
I didn't see a single one, but I had them all around me.
You probably just walked right by them.
Yeah. I think he had organized the Red Cross. They were like sending some helicopters and search dogs and stuff.
Oh my gosh.
So he had to like call them off.
What was the mood when you got back to camp? Just like glad that
relief.
You're back?
Or? Oh, just, I mean,
everyone, like nobody was mad at you.
I mean, nobody gave me the sense they were mad. I only ever got the sense of like massive relief. Like they almost lost somebody, but they didn't. Like all like the women in the kitchen, like who made meals for the, for the park and the people who worked there and like all the students. And I remember just being embarrassed, but feeling
I can
like
see that,
myself being like, I'm so ashamed that I let this happen. But I only ever got like a sense of relief from everyone else. Like they were clearly very distraught.
Yeah. Happy that you were back.
Yeah. So, I mean, that aspect of it felt good. But it's funny as my mom. So anyways, he sent this really blunt email to my mom, not knowing it was my mom. You know, basically, Andy's dead. Don't expect him to come back. But then he sent follow-up emails when I was discovered or whatever. And my parents had been away for a long weekend, so they didn't get these emails until they got back. They got them all.
Oh, geez.
And my mom read them in reverse chronological order and was like, oh, Andy's safe. What? Oh, he got lost. Oh, okay. And my dad read them in chronological order. It was like getting all worked up, you know, that I'm, Libby, Andy's lost. No, he's been found, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Do they still have those?
I have the emails somewhere. And I wrote up, like, on the plane ride, I think, home back to the U.S., I just wrote out the whole story, everything I could remember.